All right. So today we have as our guest presenter Daniel Weinstock, and Daniel got his BA and MA in political science and political philosophy here at McGill, and his doctorate in political philosophy at Oxford, and then joined the faculty of the Department of Philosophy at the Université de Montréal, where he was the founding director of the Centre de Recherche en Éthique de l'Université de Montréal. In 2012, he became a professor in the Faculty of Law and in the Department of Philosophy here at McGill. And last year, now, where were you? Honestly, where?
There was a game.
Really?
There's a bar on campus.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of people there. Right.
And do you know what we did here?
Watched the game.
We watched the game. and last year, Daniel was appointed as director of McGill's Institute for Health and Social Policy. And Daniel, welcome.
Thank you.
And if you would introduce yourself as your 20-year-old self, and where were you besides watching, I guess that was
so
not your
20-year-old
self.
So it's very possible that 20 years ago, I was just feet from here, because I lived on Mansfield, on the corner of Sherbrooke, on an apartment building that no longer exists, but that was just below Sherbrooke Street, and the philosophy department was actually on the fifth floor of this building. So it is entirely likely that 20 years ago today, I was somewhere, you know, just a few feet from here.
And if you weren't in class, where would you have been?
I would have been in the Union Building, downstairs in the Union Building, either at the McGill Daily or at Radio McGill, where I spent probably an inordinate amount of my time. With occasional bursts up to Gertrude's Pub, which used to be the real Gertrude's Pub. I understand that there's still something called Gert's on campus, but the real Gertrude's Pub, the way it used to be in the old days, was on the main floor of the Union Building, which we didn't then call the Shatner Building, just to refuel. Between the Bronfman Building, fifth floor, and the Union Building, your chances of catching me between 1980 and 1986 in one of those places is probably about 97%.
And as you imagine the few decades ahead of that until the present, what would you be doing now in your mind when you were 20?
Yeah. So I thought I'd be doing something completely different. It's one of these things where you realize when you hit, I just hit the, milestone age of 50. And you sort of take a step back and look at, the logic that governed your... there really is no logic. In 1984, I was beginning, actually, my MA. That would have been, 1983, 1984. I was finishing my BA, beginning an MA, but in a very kind of unconvinced manner. I wasn't sure that I wanted to be an academic. Actually, I was pretty sure that I didn't want to be an academic. And then what often happened, I met a girl who was convinced that she wanted to be an academic and that it would be really cool if we went off and did our graduate studies together. So at that point I decided, yeah, PhD in philosophy, that actually sounds better than it did. And off we went to Oxford, where we promptly broke up. She now works for a bank. Having been passionately devoted to all things academia, she now works for a bank. I saw her recently. She said she hasn't read an academic book in 20 years. And here I am. Professor of just to tell you that if you have some kind of plan a trajectory for your life, that's probably not what's going to happen. It'll probably be something completely different. But it's not a bad place that I've landed up in.
And just quickly, how did you see Canada in 1984?
How did I see Canada in 1984? I don't think that I really started thinking about Canada as Canada until I left. We 1984, we'd just been through the sort of the upheaval of the referendum. But it wasn't that much, when you think about it, there was never really any question of the referendum passing. I think that it ended up being a 60-40 vote. And I don't think that at any point anybody was really concerned that the country would break up, as opposed to 1995, where, the referendum came very close to passing. So, You know, I think that I spent my my teenage years in a French lycée here in Montreal, surrounded mostly by French and Francophone kids, and I was something of a sort of, you know, fellow traveler sovereignist, at least to some degree, and I still kind of get the argument. I'm going to be talking about that a little bit in my talk. I think I sort of get the argument better than a lot of people perhaps outside of Quebec get it. I still understand what fuels it. And wish that Canada were a bit more responsive to what fuels the movement. But I guess by the time I left in 1984, whatever concerns we had about the referendum, which might have led us to stepping back and thinking about what is Canada, had pretty much evaporated. And I think I really got a sense of a Canadian identity as being distinct from the United States and when I got to England. And I realized that I was surrounded by other Canadians, and I shared a lot with people from British Columbia, and yet felt myself to be very different from people who live just maybe a couple hundred miles over the border. And I think it's at that point, so 1986 is when I left for Oxford, that I really started thinking about Canada, not in a sentimental and, you know, uncritical manner, but in terms of what differentiates it from other places, and also in terms of its perhaps unrealized potential in some respects. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, 1984, we were thinking about things like, you know, South Africa. You know, the big political fight of my undergraduate life was divestment. Mm-hmm. I recently came across some pictures of myself at a demonstration just yards from here in front of the administration building where we were urging in rather strong terms that McGill divest itself from its investments in banks that did business with the apartheid government. And I remember the time where we succeeded in convincing the I'm sure that there were other arguments that, you know, had it been a complete financial ruin for the university, they probably wouldn't have allowed themselves to be convinced by a bunch of students demonstrating in front of the James Administration Building. But I remember that moment when we heard that the board had decided to divest as being, you know, that's the thing I remember. That was my political coming of age. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Thank you to Ken for inviting me. This is it's a great pleasure to be here. So, what I want to talk to you about today is so there's a joke. It's not really a joke. It's more like just a sentence that people sometimes think of as funny, but it's not really all that funny. You know what the definition of a Canadian is? The definition of a Canadian is an American with health care. You don't have to laugh. It's, you know, it's really not that funny. I think another, you know, that's what people say in the healthcare area, you know, that we're not all that different from Americans. I think we are, actually, but we have healthcare. Another thing which, you know, one of these truisms is we're, you know, the melting pot versus the mosaic. The United States is a place where people come and they assimilate, right? They melt into whatever this American sort of national identity is. Whereas we have preserved a kind of a mosaic where you can still see in the, you know, the shape of the country, the forms of the people who have come here from all parts of the world and who have not been required by either laws or by social forces to conform in quite the same way. So we have a mosaic. And so, you know, multiculturalism is something that is probably as much part of, you know, if you ask Canadians, list five things that characterize you, you know, one of them we've just done. Right, watch hockey. So I think that it's completely appropriate, and probably pedagogically, we would have been pedagogically remiss had we not done that. There probably would have been something from an academic point of view that could have been held against us. So I'm glad we did that. You know, healthcare, of course, a certain kind of compassionate society, but we'd probably refer to multiculturalism. You know, we are a multicultural society, and what I want to do for the next little while, you tell me when to stop, is sort of reflect on the degree to which we are really a multicultural society, what that means, what are some of the diversities that we have perhaps been less good at sort of taking on board in our body politic, and maybe throw out a provocation that to some degree Canada is a diverse society. Canada that really affirms diversity as a constitutive value is still very much a work in progress rather than something that we can sort of sit back and say, you know, we've done that. We've succeeded as a multicultural society. Okay, so multiculturalism. Multiculturalism emerges in the Canadian political lexicon around 1971, 1972. And if you look at the history of it, it's very interesting to see where it comes out of. Basically, we had just had a commission the Lorando Duntin Commission on the future of Canadian biculturalism, bilingualism, where various conclusions have been reached about ways in which the duality, the constitutive duality of Canada, could be preserved and promoted. And there are a lot of immigrant communities that had constituted themselves in various parts of the country that started feeling like this could be something that would squeeze them out. The vision of Canada as essentially constituted by these two peoples might end up squeezing out communities that had constituted themselves as communities in various parts of the country, and they militated very effectively before the new Liberal government of Pierre Elliott Trudeau to say, well, you know, cultural and linguistic dualism is not all there is about Canadian duality. The most effective groups in mobilizing this came out of the prairies, out of Saskatchewan. They were Ukrainians and Germans who basically made the case that, Canada is a dual, linguistically dual and nationally dual society, but it's also multicultural in the sense that it has come to be constituted by these immigrant communities that have not just dissolved into either one of the receiving national communities, be it the Francophone one here in Quebec or Anglophone communities outside of Quebec. And so multiculturalism was born as a kind of a political response to that. Now, if you look at the path of multiculturalism in Canada, it's really followed two different avenues. The first one is a legislative avenue. So it actually took quite a while. It took until the 80s before we actually had a law on multiculturalism that set up a Secretary of State for multiculturalism that actually enacted and pursued multicultural policies through the Secretariat. It's actually an interesting sort of work that could be done in seeing the way in which the Multiculturalism Secretariat has been lodged in the government. It has bounced around in a lot of different ways. There was a time in the 80s, 90s, when the Secretariat was the Secretariat for Multiculturalism and the Status of Women. They were joined together in the same Secretariat. Now, it's multiculturalism and heritage. Right? So think about what that means. Think about what it means to say that multiculturalism sort of is something that has something to do with the status of women. And then think about what it means when multiculturalism is lodged next to heritage, the past, right? The messages that are sent out by that are really quite different. And the policies that have been enacted are really quite different as well. The other place that multiculturalism occurs as a word with sort of legal and political consequence is in our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, where, so there are two lawyers in the room, right? Oh, gosh, that was a very, wow. Right. Was that me? Did I?
Yeah.
So where is the other lawyer in the room?
That's her getting called from a firm.
Oh, is that right? It's not because she thought that I was going to call on her.
And I warned her before class that was going to happen.
Oh, I see.
So it's her choice to sit on the inside of the rope.
Ah.
She'll be back and probably smiling.
Oh, good. Okay. Right. Okay. Now I'm completely thrown off my game.
Yeah.
Whatever game I had is now completely thrown off. So, other law student. Where in the charter does the word multiculturalism occur?
God.
Section 27. Section 27, which is an interpretive clause of our Constitution, which basically says that the rights that are listed in the Constitution should be interpreted in a way that protects and promotes, the word that's actually used is enhances the multicultural nature of Canadian society. So the idea is that the judges are told by the Charter, to the extent that your interpretation of the rights that are here impinges upon the multicultural nature of Canadian society, you should interpret them in a way which promotes that multicultural nature rather than one that sort of inhibits it. So multiculturalism is located in a variety of different places in our political structure. It's part of our charter. It's part of our governmental structure. There are laws and policies that reflect that. But I don't want to go into too much detail about that. I want to say basically a couple of things about multiculturalism as a reality of Canadian society. So I think that anybody who looked at Canada in 2014, and I'm going to put aside differences between Quebec and the rest of Canada for the time being, although I do want at a certain point to come back to the distinctiveness of Quebec with respect to multiculturalism, which is today rearing its head in a particular form in the debate around Bill 60. But if you look at Canadian society and you look at whether the concatenation of these different legal principles, policies, has given rise to a success or a failure, you'd probably say that it's largely been a success. Canada is a society that brings in on the order of 200 to 250,000 immigrants every year. It has done so for a long time. The policy now attracts immigrants from all around the world. The sort of Europeans first, or you know, almost whites only immigration policies that may have characterized Canada back in the 50s is a thing of the past. We have a very, very diverse society, and we have integrated that diversity in ways that have been largely A, peaceful, until recently, economically viable, both for the receiving society and for immigrants themselves. Until quite recently, if you looked at the trajectory, the economic trajectory of immigrants to Canada, you would see them hitting or even exceeding the national norms fairly quickly. Within a generation, they're doing fine. That is less the case today than it has been in the past, but it is still pretty good when you compare immigration to in Canada to other places, for example, some European countries. Now, this has given rise to a lot of Canadian self-congratulation. You know, whatever we're not sure exactly how we've done it, we're not exactly sure about which of the various policy and legal ingredients that I've just cited has been the cause of our success, but the fact is that we have succeeded in doing something that a lot of societies look upon us for with envy. I go to France quite often, where diversity is much more of a challenge than it is here, sometimes breaks out into violence in the sort of poverty-stricken, very racialized banlieues around Paris and around other urban centers. And they say, well, what have you guys done? What is the... And, you know, our very Canadian, somewhat, at times, a little bit smug reaction is to say, well, you know, just good, you know. Can't really tell you what we've done, but you know, it's just part of the Canadian genius. So one of the first provocations that I want to throw out to you is to say that I think that to a large degree, the Canadian success in multiculturalism has been the result more of good fortune.
Did you get it?
Good news?
Yeah, it's an interview.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah.
Now, I just want to get this straight that earlier on, you didn't want the class interrupted to watch the game. But anyway, we'll just leave it at that.
So what the first thought that I want to throw out at you as a kind of a provocation is to say that, you know, I think that if we look at things in a sort of cold-eyed, lucid manner, we realize that our success with multiculturalism has to a large degree been due to good fortune rather than good policy. And that to some degree, we run certain risks of our multicultural recipes running into problems if we don't realize this fact. So what do I mean by good fortune? Well, for one thing, we are geographically situated in ways that allow us to control immigration in ways that other countries that are marked by immigration just aren't. The United States has tried to control the border between Mexico and itself for years and has almost militarized that border at this point. But it's still the case that nobody knows exactly what the number of quote-unquote illegal migrants from Central and Latin America that have gone through Mexico in the United States is today. It is still largely an uncontrolled phenomenon for all of the attempts that the Americans have put in place in order to control it. We do not have a similar border that we need to police in quite the same way. Until further notice, I don't think we have to worry too much about tens of thousands of people from Vermont or Upper New York State trying to cross the border under the cover of night to settle in Canada. So we have been able to control our immigration in ways that is not true of the United States, also not true of a lot of European countries that have basically inherited hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of migrants to some degree as a result, as a sort of further chapter of the European colonial experience. So, I am a French citizen as well as being a Canadian. I go to France very often. I've lived there. And, you know, it's often hard to remember that Algeria was a part of France. It was not a colony. It was actually annexed. You could go from Algeria to France and be within the same, you were within the same country. that means that after the colonial experience had ended, France had a large number of Algerian migrants within the Hexagone, who were in large measure people who fled to France, who went to the French metropolis in pursuit of better economic, better social circumstances, but basically an immigration that was made up of poor people, people who, to the extent that they were brought into France, and I think the same is true of places like Germany, were going to occupy lower rungs in the socioeconomic ladder. So the first way in which Canada has been fortunate in the way in which it's been able to deal with multiculturalism born of immigration is that we have been able to control our borders and we have been able to enact immigration policy which has been largely self-serving. In other words, we open our doors to immigrants, to be sure, but we open our doors to immigrants who we think will serve our economic purposes. It is very difficult to immigrate to Canada. There is a point system in place, and in order to satisfy that point system, you either have to have a lot of money, a lot of the Chinese immigration to the West Coast was due to very rich Chinese people who were afraid of the Hong Kong handover in 1999. Talk back in 1999, 2000 was of British Columbia having, and these are the terms that were used, won the Hong Kong jackpot, right? These were terms that were used around 1999, 2000. We have been able to attract a lot of the money from Hong Kong that thought that it was necessary to flee because of the uncertainty of the way in which China would deal with Hong Kong once it was handed back to her by Britain. So you either have to have a lot of money or you have to have a skill set that the Canadian economy feels that it needs at a particular point in time. So apparently if you're an optometrist today, you will be given a lot of points because we seem to have a permanent optometrist shortage, something that I just learned. In Quebec, we have our own independent immigration policy, and a lot of points are given to cultural compatibility, where until very recently, cultural compatibility was understood as being able to speak French or speaking a language close enough to French that there are good reasons to think that you would be able to learn French very quickly and become a member of the linguistic majority within a number of years. So Canada has basically attracted immigrants who are rich, who have professional qualifications that allow them to enter the job market, not at the bottom of the socioeconomic echelons like is the case, say, in Germany with the Gastarbeiters, who are now two, three generations into their what was supposed to be temporary stay in Germany. We have attracted people, we have selected people in a very kind of self-serving way, who were able to enter in the core of the economic ladder to serve economic purposes that had been pre-identified by the Canadian governments as ones that we needed to have fulfilled. So the first way in which we've been very fortunate in our immigration has to do with our geographical location and the fact that that geographical location has afforded us the possibility to control immigration flows and to control immigration flows on the basis of policy, on the basis of policy with respect to the kinds of peoples that we thought could, as it were, hit the ground running when they arrived in Canada. Now, I don't want to judge the morality, pro or con, of viewing immigration policy in that manner, just to note that, there are really good reasons to think that in terms of social conflicts, in terms of social unrest, you're going to have a lot less trouble, right, before you've even enacted any policies to deal with cultural diversity, you are going to have a lot less trouble when you bring in middle class people or people who have professional qualifications that qualify them for the middle class than if you have to deal with masses of quote unquote illegal immigration from Central and Latin America over the Sierra Nevada or the results of the colonial legacy in Europe. So that's the first way in which I think we have been extremely fortunate. The second way in which I would say that we have been very fortunate is that, and perhaps this is just a sort of, almost a causal consequence of the first sort of thing, is that the claims that multicultural communities have made until very recently for accommodation have been pretty self-limiting, right? If you look at what the groups the groups that were at the origin of the political pressures that gave rise to the setting up of a multicultural policy in Canada, they didn't want to set up independent enclaves within which their own laws would hold sway. They weren't asking for accommodations which would require extremely difficult decisions to be made between, as we're seeing today, religious freedoms on the one hand and other legitimate social goals on the other. Their claims were fairly self-limiting. I worked, my first job as a university student was as a researcher for the Secretary of State for Multiculturalism, so I know a little bit of what I speak. And basically what people wanted, and this is what multiculturalism offered them as a kind of a contract, was to be able to have some funding and some recognition for immigrant organizations, ethnic organizations that would allow them to preserve certain patrimonial aspects of their identities whilst they were busy integrating into the mainstream of society, into the mainstream of the economy, into the mainstream of social institutions. So multicultural claims were not being made as a way to keep people sort of away from the mainstream. It was just, the demands that were being made were for example, money to fund ethnic organizations that would just facilitate access into the mainstream by not requiring of people that they, from one day to another, throw off patrimonial customs, patrimonial forms of association that they had brought with them from the old country, but with the expectation that over the course of a generation or two, they would be part of the mainstream. Multicultural claims were part and parcel of claims, what was required for integration, right? There was no... the kinds of requests that we are seeing to a greater degree in Quebec and that have fueled the crisis that we find ourselves in were ones that were largely absent from the multicultural picture in Canada up until at least the 1980s, 1990s. Okay? So multiculturalism in Canada has been a success story, but it has been a success story in large degree not because of the genius of our policies, but in large measure because we have been fortunate in at least those two ways. We have been able to control our immigration flows just because of our geographical situation, and we have brought people in whose multicultural claims, whose claims for multicultural accommodation were to a large degree self-limiting, right? A recipe for relative social peace in integrating peoples from different parts of the world. So I should have said at the beginning that... I could talk until the cows come home or until the Canadian-U.S. semifinal starts tomorrow, but, you can interrupt me at any point if you have questions about or comments about what I've said up until now. Everything okay? Okay, yeah?
I have a question.
Sure.
Recently I was reading the OECD came out with its report on immigration.
Yeah.
And I was reading it, and it reported that Canada takes in the largest number of refugees,
right,
compared to other countries.
Right.
I was wondering if those refugees are also selected.
Well, so
in a similar way.
No, refugees are by definition not really selected, right? Their claims for refugee status is based on the degree to which we view their claims to being in danger in their countries of origin as being justified or not. Though Canada takes in a large number of refugees, it takes in fewer than it has in the past.
Yeah.
So the relative number of refugees relative to immigrants brought in through selection has decreased radically in virtue of two factors, which don't get talked about as much as they should. One is that we now have, and this has been, I think, about 10 years now, a treaty with the United States called the Safe... The Safe Third Country. Sorry?
The Safe Third Country.
The Safe Third Country Agreement. Do people know what that is? It basically says that if you, as a refugee claimant, first set foot in your refugee odyssey in a country that is considered by Canada, or by the United States, to be safe, you have no further claim in Canada. So think about what that means geographically, right? Think about what it requires for a refugee claimant to make it to Canada first, right, before they make it anywhere else. Right, the geography speaks for itself. So the result of that is that we have, just in virtue of that treaty, radically reduced the number of refugees who even make it to the door. There are all kinds of other mechanisms through which we try to reduce. People who take airplanes on a regular basis know that there are occasions when you will be met at the door of the airplane and asked to show your passport if there is a concern or a fear that a refugee claimant may be on board. Once you touch foot on Canadian soil, you have claims for the process of refugee claim to begin. But you're not on Canadian soil when you're still on the airplane or the walkway. I know that there are extremely complex legal machinations and discussions that have that I couldn't tell you about in detail about exactly where it is that Canadian soil begins and the airplane, as it were, ends. But there are processes through which we try to limit even above and beyond what the safe third country gives rise to. There have been other. And the other thing is the range of types of claims that we are willing to accept as refugee claims, right? You have to be able to show not that, you know, for example, that you will be in a situation of extreme economic duress if you go back to your country. It's not a sufficient ground for claiming refugee status. You have to be able to show that you will be, under the risk of death or violence at the hands usually of state agents. In order to make the claim. So it is the case that we still take in a fair degree, a fair number of refugees, but we don't take in nearly as many as we did even 10 years ago. And we are trying as much as we can, our government is trying as much as it can to take in even fewer within the bounds of the international sort of treaties and agreements that we are subject to.
And is that because we want to be able to select it?
It's hard for me to get inside the mind of the legislators. You can imagine all kinds of reasons that one might have to want to, refugees are often people who, well, they aren't people who we've selected for their economic, potential. It's a costly process, right? Each refugee, if you put aside humanitarian and moral considerations, which I would argue that we should not put aside, right? But if you put them aside, it is a costly process, right? Taking on a refugee is probably more costly than taking on a new immigrant who's been selected in the kind of process that I've described. Yep?
What are your thoughts on the government's decision to freeze the immigration investors program, or investment immigration, I don't know, just that program?
So which, I wasn't aware that they'd done that, so.
Yeah, well, it used to be that you can someone with a lot of money
could buy their way in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they decide to freeze it.
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts on the government's decision?
Yeah. I mean, my sorry?
Is it the skilled workers?
No, it's not that. Skilled workers for skilled workers, but this one is for people who has.
Yeah. My off-the-cuff thoughts would tend to be somewhat skeptical because there are all kinds of examples of people who have been granted accelerated admission to Canada outside of that program, who have essentially bought their way in. So I think that we are, it's always been a very controversial thing, the idea that you can buy your way into Canada. I think that people are still doing it through the back door outside of the, I have a colleague at the University of Toronto, Ayala Chahar, who has just written a book called, has the word Olympic in it, actually. The anecdote that starts off the book is, I think it's Switzerland or I can't remember what country, that essentially it's something that is, we've probably witnessed several instances of this in the last 10 days, of countries that will essentially fast-track Olympic athletes to citizenship so that they can, compete under the banner of that country in violation of every single immigration rule that is actually on the books. And so she uses that as a kind of a metaphor for the kind of bidding and competition that various countries, including Canada, have gone into in order to attract not just Olympic talent, but other kinds of Olympic-style talent, business, what have you, by using all kinds of backdoor mechanisms that are not explicitly accounted for in the program that you mentioned. So I would suspect that it hasn't changed all that much, but I may be wrong. Right? I'm not up to date on the latest things that have happened. So the are there any other questions or comments?
I just wanted to, I'm not sure if this is the same program, but what I read is that what they were going to do is lift the freeze on taxation, because there is a program in place where if you come with a certain amount of money, with a certain amount of wealth, the government gives you a grace from taxation, from income taxation for 5 years.
Right.
So what they're doing, so you effectively can still get in with large amount of money. You're still a welcome, you know, potential Canadian, but you no longer have any tax benefits.
Right.
But I don't know if that's essentially the same thing, if that many people are that motivated by tax shelter.
I have to admit completely, in complete honesty, that I couldn't tell you the detail of, you know, the latest changes in policy. The general point I wanted to make, though, is that, again, what success we have had in integrating up to 250,000 immigrants a year in Canada has perhaps, you know, been more a result of favorable circumstances than of well-thought-out policy. Now, the second point that I want to make today is to go back to what I said earlier on about the various locations in which multiculturalism occurs as a policy plank, as a legal principle, as a constitutional principle, and make the following suggestion to you. To the extent that multiculturalism has evolved over the course of the last, say, 15 to 20 years, it has been the result more of the action of the courts than of the legislature. If you look at multiculturalism policy today, the heyday of investment in multiculturalism, always follow the money. Look at where the government is investing large amounts of money. The heyday of investment in multiculturalism, say, in the early 90s up until perhaps the mid-90s, where, for example, a lot of money was being poured into ethnic organizations in order to allow them to carry out the kinds of functions that I mentioned, that heyday is well past. Multiculturalism is a blip on the government's budgetary list of budgetary priorities today, and the kind of work that is carried out to the Secretary of State for Multiculturalism today, essential, important work to be sure, has more to do with doing anti-discrimination, anti-racism work, more than the promotion of ethnic organizations. So in other words, multiculturalism has become more of a defensive than an offensive policy, if you see what I mean. We want to make sure that immigrants are not discriminated against in the workplace, that they're not discriminated against when they are trying to sign a lease, that they are not targeted for harassment. All important functions, but functions which could easily be taken on even by a society that doesn't consider itself a multicultural society, like France. When I go back to France, there are a lot of organizations that fight for the rights of immigrants not to be discriminated against, but not in order for them to sort of preserve their distinctive cultures, just in order that they be able to fold into the cultural and economic mainstream. So if you look at the way in which multiculturalism policy has evolved as a policy through the Secretary of State for Multiculturalism, I think that what you'd see over the course of the last 20 or 25 years is a gradual decline in the level of governmental interest in investing a lot of resources in the promotion of distinctive multicultural identities. All right? Ethnic organizations now have to look elsewhere, have to look for private funds if they want to maintain themselves. The government is less interested than it has been, certainly for, you know, over the course of the last 10 or 15 years, it has been a story of less and less interest rather than more and more. Move over to the to the judicial side, and essentially, you know, post-1982, the court has been very interested in being active in the way in which multicultural rights are defined. So from 1984, which is the first big Supreme Court decision that has a kind of a multicultural flavor, which is a case that is called Big M Drug Mart, which has to do with Sunday closing laws, where the court decided essentially that it was discriminatory for the government to impose Sunday as a mandatory day of rest for everybody, up until very recently in cases like the Amsalem decision, which was a local decision. Do people know about the Amsalem decision? A decision of the Supreme Court in which the right of religious Jews in Outremont to be able to build... Do people know the case? I won't go into detail unless people ask me. It was a case about, I guess, 10 years ago now, where a group of Orthodox Jews who'd bought some condominiums in a condominium complex nearby here in Outremont had been prevented from building sukkah. Sukkah are temporary structures that are built by religious Jews during what is essentially the harvest feast,
right? And the idea is that for a week, I think, or 8 days, it's a week in Israel, 8 days in the diaspora, you're supposed to take your meals in this temporary structure, right? Some people extend it to actually sleeping in it. In Montreal, depending on when Sukkot falls, that's sometimes a dubious proposition when it's later in the fall. But at least take their meals in it. So these religious Jews had started building sukkah on their balconies, and the board of the condominium complex reminded them that they signed a contract when they had arrived in the condominium complex, saying that they agreed not to do anything that altered the nature of the building, right? That altered the nature of the structure, and pointed out that even if it's only for 8 days, the sukkah built on the balcony did actually alter the nature of the building, made it perhaps a little bit more unsightly for people driving by who might be considering whether they wanted to buy a condominium in the complex as well. The case made it up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that the religious freedom of these people trumped the contractual obligation that they had inherited in virtue of signing the contract that had been pointed to by the owners of the condominium complex. And in reaching their decision, the majority, it was, I think, a 5-4 decision, invoked Section 27 that I've talked about before. This may look like it's just a religious freedom case, the court says, but we are under the obligation, a constitutional obligation, to interpret religious freedoms in a way that promotes and enhances Canada's multicultural nature, right? So the argument goes, in case of a tie, in case of a sort of equipoise between the legal considerations that are at play here, religious freedom on the one hand, contractual obligations on the other, Section 27 allows us to tip the balance in a way in favor of religious freedom, because religious freedom sort of has the religious freedom, when it is interpreted in a capacious manner, in effect enhances and promotes the multicultural nature of Canadian society. So to the extent that there has been movement in the direction of expanding and enhancing Canada's multicultural mosaic, right? I would argue that it has come to a larger degree through the courts than through the legislature. As I said, the legislature, I think, and the Secretary of State for Multiculturalism, which was created through the 1988 law, has largely become an institution poorly funded that, to the extent that it does anything, is there to defend the anti-racism, anti-discrimination rights, not just of immigrants, but of all visible minorities within Canada. To the extent that there has been promotion and enhancement of Canada's multicultural mosaic, I would argue that it has come through the courts to a larger degree than it has through the legislature. Now, you might say, so what? Big deal, you know. I think that there's a danger there, and that's a third point that I want to make for you today. So, and now I want to talk a little bit about Quebec. Multiculturalism has a bad odor in Quebec, and it has a bad odor in Quebec for reasons that are largely historical and that essentially run as follows. The history of multiculturalism as read in Quebec does not refer back to the Ukrainian and Mennonite migrants to Saskatchewan that I talked about at the beginning of my talk. Rather, it points back to what a lot of Quebecers view as the malevolent intentions of Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Pierre Elliott Trudeau was the father of the Trudeau that we have now. You might have not know that. Whose intention through multiculturalism, as this story goes, was to water down the particular distinctiveness of Quebec. So in the story that is told about multiculturalism here in Quebec, the idea was that when Quebec sovereignists got up in Ottawa or wherever and said, Canada is a binational society, we are a distinct society, the response from multiculturalism would be to say, yeah, you're distinct, everybody's distinct, we're all distinct. We are a big, happy family of distinctivenesses, where no distinctiveness is more important than any other distinctiveness. Now, you know, as any story, it, you know, has perhaps a kernel of truth and a lot of mystification and obfuscation and historical rewriting. But that's the reason why multiculturalism has a kind of a bad odor here in Quebec. If you look at what has actually been happening in Quebec up until fairly recently, up until I would argue about 10 years ago, you would actually view practices on the ground that were for all the world indistinguishable from the ones that were going on in the rest of Canada. The multiculturalism story small M multiculturalism now rather than big M policy multiculturalism. The multiculturalism story was as happy a story in Quebec as it was in the rest of Canada. When I started working as a researcher, 17, 18 years old, there was a ministère des communautés culturelles in the government of Quebec, and the minister for a number of years was a gentleman by the name of Gérald Godin. Those of you who live on the plateau know that there's a square now just outside the Mount Royal metro station that bears his name. Gérald Godin was plucked out of, he was a poet, right, and a professor of literature in a university. He was plucked out of, the PQ came to power in 1976. Nobody expected that they would form the government. It was a surprise to everybody, including René Lévesque himself. If you look at some of the old footage of René Lévesque on the night of the election, there's part, hooray, we've won, and part, what are we going to do now? They were not really ready for prime time, although they ended up being quite a decent government, and some of the people that they had to put in ministerial positions were poets, right, who were really not expecting to be in government the following week. Gérald Godin was a loved, revered Minister of Cultural Communities within the cultural communities of Quebec. He was about as generous with cultural communities as the most forward-looking Secretary of State for Multiculturalism in Ottawa could ever be. So the multiculturalism story in Quebec, even though it dared not speak that name, right, was a very happy one until fairly recently. I would identify the point at which the shift that we are now seeing perhaps the culmination of with Bill 60, I would see the shift as having occurred with a Supreme Court case from about, I guess, 10 years ago now called Multani. Do people know the Multani decision? So the Multani decision was, again, a Montreal case. A young Sikh boy who was playing, who was going to a public school in a very multicultural part of the city, and he was playing outside, and something happened. He was jostled, and his kirpan fell out of his clothes. A kirpan is a small ritual dagger which some Sikh men see it as an obligation to wear. The school, the principal was called in, the parents were called in. You know, your son can't wear, what is essentially to us a dagger while he's playing in the school. It was explained that from the point of view of the Sikh religion, the dagger is not actually an offensive weapon. It's actually seen as a symbol of peace. No Sikh boy would ever contemplate using it in an offensive way. Across Canada, there are Sikh boys, men who wear the kirpan. No recorded incidents of any violence, any injury having occurred across the country due to the kirpan. So actually, in an agreement that betokened or bore witness to the good faith of all the parties present, the school said, okay, your son can continue to come to school with a kirpan, but on condition that it be tightly sheathed in a kind of a cloak that just makes it difficult to access, right? Because what we don't want is for it to fall out and for some other kid to take it and start, there could be injury there. Parents said, perfectly reasonable, we agree, let's do that. It's when the school board got a hold of this decision that they decided, no. You know, the security of our children requires that, the kirpan be nowhere near the school grounds. Forget about the fact that, kids often come to school with baseball bats and hockey sticks, with which they can do all kinds of damage to themselves if they so choose. The school board decided that this had to end and that the kirpan had to be banned. The case was argued up to the Supreme Court. By that point, the young Multani kid was, I think, like 47 or something. And the Supreme Court, in a 9-0 decision, so a unanimous decision, said, yes, the security interest is there, but the restriction of the religious freedom is it's overly strong given the effect that it's trying to achieve. Security can be achieved with the compromise that was proposed by the parents and the school. And, again, we have to look at the evidence. The evidence from the entire country is that there has been no recorded incident where a kid with a kirpan had been involved in any kind of incident causing bodily harm. So 9-0 decision. The rest of Canada, I think, shrugged its collective shoulders and said, sounds fine, right? There are a lot more Sikhs in other parts of the country than there were in Quebec at that point. There might have been a process of sort of familiarity that was greater in Ontario, British Columbia, than in Quebec. So the rest of the country basically shrugged its shoulders, said, well, of course this was the right decision. Tell us something else. In Quebec, in some degree due to a media outlet which shall remain nameless that had decided for various reasons that it was going to start pointing a spotlight on the process of religious accommodation that was, in its view, being sort of religious accommodation being granted in exaggerated, excessive manner in Quebec. The Multani case was presented as a radical break between Quebec and the rest of the country. Whereas the rest of the country, as I said, shrugged its collective shoulders, the reaction in Quebec was the rest of Canada has taken leave of its senses. Drunk in the sort of, you know, this mistaken ideology of multiculturalism, they are ready to sacrifice the security of your children, of our children, before the mantle, the false idol of multiculturalism. We have to claim our difference here and say that this will not stand in Quebec. We have to regiment and govern the practice of reasonable accommodation to a much greater degree than we have. And what we're seeing today with Bill 60, which for a lot of you, how many of you are from Quebec? Wow. So by definition, the rest of you are, I guess, not from Quebec. How many of you are from Canada outside Quebec? Wow, okay. Right, so it still takes a while for me to get used to this. I was at University of Montreal where, you know, if I'd asked that question, it would have been the reverse proportions, right? A couple of people from outside the province and the vast majority from here. So I think for a lot of Canadians, Bill 60, this thing that we are considering in the National Assembly today, sort of comes out of nowhere. You know, what are these people talking about? Right? Why all of a sudden are we worrying about religious symbols and reasonable accommodation? But what you have to see, and without, you know, going anywhere in the direction of justifying it, Bill 60 is the culmination to date of a process of questioning the Canadian multicultural model that has been going on now for about 10 years, at least since the Multani decision, right? At least since the Multani decision. We could go back to talking about Bill 60 in a second, and why am I bringing it up? I'm bringing it up for the following reason. The rest of Canada, I would argue, is not really immune to the kind of putting into question of multiculturalism that we have seen in Quebec in the last 10 years. Canada could have its Multani. There could be a decision coming down the pike where you know, a significant opinion within Canada would say, wait a minute, the limit has been breached. We are going too far. So a lot of Quebec bashing has occurred in the last few months or even years about the way in which we have dealt with religious diversity, limits to religious freedom. Bill 60 is pointed out to be something that could only happen in Quebec, right? Those intolerant Quebecers, you know, clearly this couldn't happen in the rest of Canada. Polls indicate that when Canadians outside of Canada are asked whether they would approve of a law that would restrict religious freedom in much the same way that Bill 60 proposes to restrict the religious freedom of Quebecers, the response rate, the positive response rate, is surprising. It is in the high 30s, low 40s. Now, the big difference between Quebec and Canada for the time being is that, first of all, there is no vehicle, political vehicle, for that opinion yet in the rest of Canada. The Progressive Conservatives have basically decided that it's bad politics to try to alienate the ethnic vote. They are courting it just as much as anybody else. And I can't see any province yet within which there is the kind of political vehicle for this kind of view that the Parti Québécois has decided to be in the present context. Parti Québécois has not always been like this, and I could tell a whole story about the evolution or the devolution of the Parti Québécois from a very inclusive, sort of open nationalist party to a much more nativist party, to a much more sort of exclusivist party that it is at the present day. But the point I want to make is that it's not as if when you ask Canadians, right, you know, Canadians are English Canadians, we Quebecers are used to English Canadians engaging in a little bit of Quebec bashing from time to time. It's a national pastime. But when you ask Canadians, okay, you know, forget about the Quebec bashing, what do you think about the actual content of the law? And you go through it clause by clause, you find surprising numbers of Canadians saying, yeah, we'd be willing to contemplate that. It doesn't seem completely egregious to us. Now, the concern that I have for the rest of Canada is basically this. Like a lot of issues Canadians have decided to give over or have backed into a situation in which they have given over discussion of a lot of the hot-button issues that tend to make legislators run for cover, and maybe Ken can either confirm or deny. They have decided, English Canadians have decided, to give these issues over to the court. Another issue that I've been very involved with in recent years has to do with end-of-life care and the question of whether we should decriminalize assisted suicide and euthanasia. I was part of a group that was struck by the Royal Society of Canada, which is a sort of academic association, that was asked to make recommendations to the government about how the issue of end-of-life care should be dealt with. We issued our report, and when we issued our report, the Conservatives are obviously not very interested in the question of opening up euthanasia and assisted suicide. But even the New Democrats, my friends in the New Democratic Party, said, you know what, we don't really want to touch this issue. At some point, the court will tell us what to do, right? The Carter decision from British Columbia. Anybody from British Columbia here? People know about the Carter decision that's making its way up to the Supreme Court right now? Anyway, you know, at some point, the Supreme Court will tell us what we should think about this, right? In Quebec, the issue, actually, as we speak, there is debate in the National Assembly over a bill, Bill 52, which recommends the decriminalization of assisted suicide and euthanasia under certain circumstances, which was a bill that was arrived at through a parliamentary process. A nonpartisan, cross-party committee was formed about 5 years ago. It issued a report. The report was the object of a National Assembly Commission where people were able to come in and give their opinions. They were listened to. The bill was reviewed. So I think there's a difference in political culture between Quebec and Canada, where I think Quebecers are less prone than their Canadian fellow citizens to giving over issues, hot-button issues, to determination by the courts. Let's wait until the court tells us what to think, and then we'll think it. And they are more inclined, for reasons which don't have anything to do with political virtue, but perhaps with a greater suspicion that Quebecers may have of the court, of the judicial process. After all, the Canadian Charter, as the story goes here in Quebec, was voted in as part of a constitutional package, which we never consented to, right? So the court that has been empowered by that constitution to review legislation is something that we tend to view as perhaps less legitimate than other Canadians do. So maybe it just has to do something to do with that. But in the rest of Canada, I think that there has been an insufficient attention and discussion of these kinds of issues. The worry that I have is that a decision may come down the pike, right, which will have the effect in the rest of Canada that Multani had in Quebec, where there will all of a sudden be a backlash of the kind that we saw here in Quebec. It could come with a decision on something like polygamy. It could come, you know, I can see a range of cases that could give rise to the same kind of backlash in the rest of Canada. And the opinion polls that I pointed to that show that Canadians may not be as wedded to, or you know, may be more ready to consider the kinds of restrictions on religious freedom that we've seen here in Quebec, suggest to me that there's a danger in simply leaving these issues up to determination by the courts. I'll take a break and...
I'd just like to follow up on a few of these things. I'm not even sure quite where to begin. I mean, you've described multiculturalism and the impact of laws, the impact of policies. It seems to me as really what's happened is that life has determined what multiculturalism is like, and that people. And that the moments that you talk about, whether they're legal cases, or whether occasionally it will hit the legislature, and you talked about the PQ and how their history is one thing, but their way of functioning now may be different.
Yeah.
Is that where trouble comes, is when definitional moments happen.
Yeah.
And the absence of definitional moments. Life goes on.
Absolutely.
And the way in which we live gets, you know, and live with each other and live with diversity becomes more and more comfortable, and less and less problematic.
I agree.
And that the challenge for anything is, and I think we talked about this in one of the other classes, is that at what point, like if you have your name, a comma, and then you start into elements of identity, of identifiers of you after that, at what point do some of these things come in? And is that definition of identity right after your name one that relates to a specific cultural identity or a racial identity, or over time does it get shifted down the line and so it comes after the fourth comma rather than after the first comma?
Right.
But at certain moments, even if it's after the fourth comma, if there's a definitional moment, suddenly it gets shifted back to right after the first comma. And even if, in fact, in the nature of your life and those things that you consider most valuable and central to you, it has shifted along because it has, you know, come to be a central moment, you end up focusing on it as if it is a central moment. I remember, you know, and I think maybe it came up when you were talking about the 1995 referendum, and I think I probably told this story before, but of how in the months leading up to that, there was all kinds of commentary in the English newspapers in Canada about how it's not a big deal anymore. Quebecers have changed; they're much more outward looking. Their priorities are much less in terms of just Quebec. The younger generation sees themselves as part of the world and all of that. And I remember reading those things and thinking to myself, you've got it all wrong.
I think I agree with that. Yeah.
Because as soon as you create a referendum, all of a sudden you shift the commas.
That's absolutely right.
And it becomes the central question in it, even if you don't think it's a central question in your life.
Right.
So you get into these awkward moments here of where, you know, that legislatures are kind of running for the hills.
Yeah.
I think mostly what it is to avoid the definitional moment.
Yeah.
The problem is, of course, the courts can't avoid the definitional moment.
Right.
It comes to them. They've got to come down with a decision of some sort.
Right.
And it may have immense implications out of all of that because suddenly it becomes, you know, a core question in it. You would know this, and I don't. My speculation, when you talk about the change of the PQ in this, is that they've come to understand that in order to have that much of a better chance at generating a sovereign Quebec, is that you've got to create definitional moments. You've got to, because day to day, moment to moment, it's not so big of a deal for a huge majority of Quebecers.
Right.
So, you know, what are those definitional moments?
Right.
Well, the big one, of course, is a referendum.
Yeah.
But short of that, it may be in questions like this. And whereas, you know, for the rest of the time, I mean, people are really living the reasonable accommodation life, except if you decide that becomes the definition of the way in which you relate, and then it doesn't seem so reasonable anymore.
Yeah. So let me put it a slightly different way. I think that in virtue of the kind of society that it is. Quebec, you know, 7 million French speakers in an ocean of 350 million English speakers. Definitional moments, you know, there are definitional moments that rise above the waterline. But just underneath the surface, we're always in a kind of a definitional moment. The PQ, the strange political animal, you know, is really a party that is made up of all kinds of people that have nothing to do in the same political bed, but for the fact that they are all in favor of Quebec sovereignty. The minute Quebec achieves sovereignty, the PQ will explode into 29 constituent bits, as well it should. And so the PQ, which has been, you know, one of the two parties of government since 1976, is a constant conversation about what kind of society Quebec should be. There's a kind of self-reflexivity in Quebec society. It makes it exhausting to live here, year after year after year, because it doesn't take very much You know who Régent Tremblay is. Mm-hmm. Régent Tremblay is a sports writer, right, who is capable of making definitional moments mm-hmm. around who the Canadians draft, right? And I'm not joking. You know, it is an absolute, we have these Anglophone owners who do not take seriously the importance for the Quebec identity of, the CH, and that they should be drafting. And this is a political issue. So, you know, it doesn't take very much to bring that conversation, to bring that sort of constant thinking about who we are just up above the waterline. So there are definitional moments where all of a sudden we're in a state of crisis, but I cannot remember a single point in living in Quebec, even when things were going relatively peacefully and we were kind of like in the ordinary, just living accommodation happily, where I could say we are now in a sort of happy unreflexivity, just going about our lives and not really thinking about the kind of society that Quebec is. Now, thinking about the kind of society that Quebec is, by definition, involves thinking about the relationship of Quebec to its migrants. I could tell a very long story, which I won't tell. I'll just give the sort of highlight moments. The PQ has basically been a pendulum swing for years and years and years between leaders and groups within the party who feel that the only way forward for Quebec is for Quebec to project an open and inclusive image of the Quebec nation to its immigrants. If we are going to have a sovereign Quebec, it's going to have to be a sovereign Quebec whose sovereignty is grounded in reasons that you don't have to be a 17th generation Quebecer in order to be able to appreciate. The high watermark of that tendency was the premiership of Lucien Bouchard and the role of his brother, Gérard Bouchard, in sort of laying the intellectual infrastructure for that. We are now today in Quebec seeing the backlash against that. And you can name names. Jacques Beauchemin, who is now a deputy minister who basically wrote Bill 60. He is the guy who is Bernard Brinville's deputy minister, wrote books, wrote articles in which he said, this is a mistake. You cannot achieve sovereignty without tapping into the energy and the identitarian fuel of the old stock community. The denationalization, to use the word that's often used, of the Quebec sovereignist movement was a mistake. It was a dead end, and we now have to renationalize the movement. Bill 60 is, in part, the manifestation of that. I don't want to go into that too much, although if people have questions about that, I'm happy to answer them. What I want to point out in bouncing off of Ken's remark about definitional moments is Quebec is, for better and for worse, a place that is in constant questioning of its identity and its identity relative to its new arrivals, relative to immigration, where the slightest thing, hockey drafts, can spark a kind of questioning. So it's better for worse. Worse because it's just exhausting, right? It's very hard to relax in this society and think that, we've arrived. We've arrived at some kind of stasis, some kind of balance where everybody has gotten a little bit of what they want. Now we can go on and live our lives, right? It's an exhausting place to live. Good place to visit, but if you're not born here, you might not necessarily want to spend your whole life. But I think that it has some advantages, and this is the point that I want to make. We have been having a constant conversation about these issues for years and years and years and years, and I think that that conversation is to some degree lacking in English Canada. So that, it has benefited. That was the first part of my presentation. My first part of the presentation was to say it's not that there's some grand theory of multiculturalism, some grand theory of Canadian diversity that we have implemented and it has worked, and now we can pat ourselves on the back and, say what geniuses we are politically. We have just been lucky. We have just been lucky. There is no grand theory of Canadian multiculturalism, even in embryo, that we can repair to so that when a definitional moment comes, we can say, okay, what was that conversation we were having? There's a script here. There's a story that we can get back to in order to think our way out of this this problem. I think that the tendency that English Canada has had to send all of the hot button issues over to the court in order to absolve the legislature and the citizens from thinking about these issues too much may end up being a risk for English Canada that it doesn't appreciate to its full degree today. You disagree?
Well, maybe, but I think I would start with the way in which we live, I was in the UK a couple of years ago, just for a couple of weeks talking to groups there that, I mean, they, you know, their word is diversity. I mean, that's, you know, they don't talk about multiculturalism. You know, they talk about diversity. And these are, you know, very prominent groups in the UK and also in Europe. And all of them, of course, they look at Canada in this sort of dumbfounded way of how do you do it? I mean, how does all of this happen? I don't understand how you are able to do this. We can't do this kind of thing. And of course, when you're listening to it, instinctively, your reaction is no. Like, why do you think that we are doing so well with it? I mean, we see these problems and we see the debates that happen and the conflict that happens, and it's and then their reaction is yeah, but, and so I mean, I think that the fact of the matter is that we are doing better than other places are, and so. You know, that in part, I think, you know, as you described some of the, you know, the nice advantages of being able to kind of control your world to a great extent. I mean, it's when these things get out of control that then the bigger picture gets out of control. And so if you can control your borders mostly,
yeah,
that's an immense, you know, benefit.
Yeah.
At the same time, and it's something we'll get into, you know, later on in the course, is that you know that we have found a way of basically you know just kind of getting along, yeah, as if getting along is not just kind of a throwaway phrase, but is actually kind of an essential feature of life, and so that you know rarely is something, you know, kind of a big enough deal to get in the way of getting along.
Right.
And so as you talk about, you know, the rest of Canada and allowing just the courts to do this or that and the worry and the risk, I understand the worry and the risk. At the same time, I also understand, you know, that what has played out.
Yeah.
And whether it is for luck or whether it's for a lot of other reasons, that what has played out is better than what has played out elsewhere.
Right.
And so then, and I understand exactly what you're saying in terms of Quebec, of around every corner is a definitional moment, and you don't even need to go around the corner. I mean, if you want to create a definitional moment, it's there.
Yeah.
And there are always people that are looking to do that. And you talked about, you know, the Canadians. I mean, I remember every year we would have an incident. I mean, you know, that it would happen. I mean, you know, that we would be winning and winning and winning and winning, but there would be something that would happen that would generate, you know, the French English, the players don't get along, you know, that they, and so on. You know, well, you know, that what was really happening, of course, is that through the prism of somebody else's life that doesn't function in a way that is essentially non-linguistic as a sports life is, then all of this was real disruption. In terms of what it felt like as living life, it wasn't. It was just kind of normal, yeah, disagreement that happens every so often, right, and is no big deal.
Right.
So I can understand where, you know, that and my question to you in terms of Quebec, to a great extent, is that do you ever get over that kind of tension, the exhaustiveness of the whole thing, or because it is so ever-present,
yeah,
and so not far beneath the surface, that if you want to scratch that surface, you know, deep enough, you're going to get to it and you're going to create a definitional moment. And once you get into those moments, you have no idea how it's going to turn out in the end.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, to some degree, Well, let me say two things. The first thing is, if you had told me 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, let's go back into a little bit of potted history. 1995, the second referendum. Remember the speech that was made by then Premier Jacques Parizeau, when he found out that the referendum was lost. He said, yes, it's true, we lost, but why? Because of money and an ethnic vote. Remember that? You were all probably too young to remember, but it has gone down in history as, one of the great sort of shocks to this. It was a shocking moment. I remember when I was in my parents-in-law basement, we were watching this, and there was a stunned silence, and my father-in-law, after about 5 or 6 seconds, said, did he just say what I think he just said? And if you look it up on YouTube, Radio-Canada pans to the crowd, and there's some people who are clapping, and there are other people whose jaws just drop. Now, we're talking about Péquiste, we're talking about sovereignists, we're talking about people who had gone to wherever it was, I can't remember which of the arenas, in order to either celebrate the victory of the referendum or mourn its loss, and you could tell that they just couldn't believe it. This was a betrayal. I went to the university the next day, where a lot of my friends were sort of, non-ethnic nationalists who really believed that this was an inclusive movement that could embrace everybody. They were in tears. They were in tears of betrayal, and they said, that's it for us. We don't want to have anything to do with this anymore. We really thought that we had rid the movement of this, and so I really thought that that was the point at which it was the last sort of surge of a kind of a moment of ethnic exclusivism, which was then purged from the body politic of the Parti Québécois. And for years and years and years under Lucien Bouchard, we didn't really hear from very much. And we were kind of in that happy moment from the mid-90s to maybe the mid-noughts of just, accepting our diversity and our multiculturalism, though we don't call it that, right? We call it interculturalism here. Just as happily as other Canadians did. If you had told me in 2005, 2006 that we'd be having, maybe 2004, 2005, that we would be having the debates that we're having right now, which are tearing the society apart. These are the most acrimonious debates that I can remember having in Quebec, even including the referenda. I would have said, no, I don't see it coming. I really think that we've gone beyond that. And yet here we are.
But I guess that's my question. Are we ever beyond that?
I think that Quebec's location in North America makes it the case that, a lot of my sovereignist friends say, well, if we achieve sovereignty, there's a kind of fear that we wouldn't have anymore. I travel to Europe, I go to places like Sweden and Norway, where people have, Sweden is close to having taken on English as an official second language. If you write a dissertation, a thesis in a Swedish or a Norwegian university, it's pretty much expected that you'll write it in English. Because who would want to write a dissertation in a language that's spoken by, 3 million other people? Right, it's university life. I go to the University of Denmark very often. It is as Anglophone as McGill or as Oxford is. Danish is something that people speak while they're smoking a cigarette before going back into the room to speak English, which is the real language of international science. Are they anxious about the disappearance of their language? You bet they are. They are torn between, on the one hand, the realization that business, culture, is happening in English, and that they don't have a language that is global enough to make it attractive for kids to invest in. So does sovereignty exempt?
But isn't it very different in that regard, of where, that you may be a Swede, and Swedish may be your first language, and English may be your second language. And even if there's a much greater shift over to English, you're still speaking English as a Swede within your own space.
Yeah.
Or a Dane within your own space. Yeah. It is your space.
So this actually leads me to, and people should feel free to jump in at any point. I have a few other things that I wanted to say.
We'll take a break in about a couple of minutes, and then everybody will jump in crazy. Yeah. But
so I actually had a three-part presentation, I only really did the first part. So I'm just going to announce the themes that the two other parts would have been about. I think that Canada has, there are three diversities that Canada has to deal with. And one of them is the one that we tend to refer to as multiculturalism. Diversity born of immigration. And the take-home point that I wanted to try to impress upon you, perhaps out of provocation more than anything is, yes, we've done well, but maybe we've done well because we've been lucky rather than good. Point number one. The two other diversities, I think, are ones that we have been, frankly, quite bad at. One has to do with the increasing, and I speak as a Quebecer here, the increasing sort of putting aside, forgetting of the binational nature of Canadian society. I think that there is something that is obvious to every Quebecer, even Quebecers who aren't sovereignists, even Quebecers who have decided that if only for pragmatic reasons, keeping ourselves within the Canadian Federation just makes sense. Why rock the boat? Things are going pretty well. You know, there is a sense that there is a disconnect between the way in which the rest of Canada perceives the country, 10 provinces equal in all respects, and the way that we perceive the country. It is essentially a compact between two founding peoples, right, that is going to continue to be a thorn in our side. And it's something that we have trouble understanding on the part of the rest of Canada. How can what is so obvious to us, and it's what is probably so obvious to people who come to Quebec, I hope that you get beyond the McGill community and the McGill ghetto in your time here, because McGill is a very strange kind of place, kind of an enclave of Anglophonia in, you know, drive 50 kilometers in any direction, and you're in a very different place. I think people who come here and who get to know Quebec realize, yeah, wait a minute, this distinct society stuff, they actually kind of have a point. This is pretty different. You know, this actually feels like kind of like a country, you know, with its own language and its own sense of having a place within the Federation that is quite different from the way in which the Constitution defines that place. So I think, you know, to talk about the Constitution these days, let's reopen the Constitution, think about these issues again. Tom Mulcair, I think, mentioned it at some point. His pollsters said, Tom, loser, you know, don't say that again. You know, if you want to be the Prime Minister of this country, do not say the word Constitution again. But from a philosophical point of view, and forgetting about questions of political strategy, it is something which I think remains unfinished work on the part of Canadian society to figure out what the relationship of this particular place is to the whole. The allergy of Canadians to anything that smacks of asymmetrical federalism, which is actually a kind of arrangement that other places in the world have latched onto quite happily, is something that remains, I think, a problem that may end up biting us in the rear end at some point again. And the third, of course, has to do with our First Nations. You know, when we pat ourselves on the back in self-congratulation, I'll really stop in a couple of minutes, about how well we do with our immigrants relative to, say, France or Germany or England or other places, I say, look, you know, one very big difference that I didn't talk about in the first part of my presentation, but which perhaps is part of the fortunate set of circumstances that we have had as well, is we have no fraught relationship with our immigrants. They do not perceive themselves as erstwhile colonial subjects of us. They are just people who have decided to pick up and start a new life in a different place. You know, the relationship of a Belgian person who moves to Quebec or a Pakistani person who moves to Ontario is not one of, you know, this is a continuing chapter in a very fraught, tense colonial relationship that is now going to be fought out under different guise. It's just a new encounter. And we benefit from the fact that that encounter occurs without any baggage. In France, you know, Algerian subjects, there are still people for whom the Algerian War is living memory. You know, family members tortured is living memory. Of course it's going to be difficult to manage that relationship when that legacy is still there. If you want to get a real sense of how well we're doing relative to people with whom we are in a colonial or just slightly post-colonial relationship, look at the European settler communities and our Aboriginal communities, and you will see that we have nothing to congratulate ourselves over relative to the way in which the French or the Germans or the Portuguese deal with their erstwhile colonial subjects. So I think that, you know, if we think of Canada's three diversities, we've been doing well with multiculturalism, but maybe because we've been lucky rather than good. And I still think that we're doing pretty poorly with respect to the two other ones. And, you know, I, as someone who, looks towards the future, towards the still unfulfilled potential of Canada as a place that really embraces diversity as a constitutive aspect of our Constitution, as a constitutive aspect of our lives, would hope that we not ignore those two other diversities either. So I was going to say a lot more about the two others, but I want to hear from you guys, and we should probably stop for a break now. Yeah. Continue the conversation afterwards.
So why don't we take 10 minutes...